This week, we're going to spend the hour talking about whether AI in higher education narrows the gap or widens it. And before we get into the conversation, here's the thing that has been nagging at me all week. The single most cited piece of evidence for the optimist case. The finding that generative tools lift the bottom of the skill distribution faster than the top comes from one study, in one task domain, with one cohort of consultants. It is a real finding. I am not contesting it. But it is doing an enormous amount of moral work in our sector, and the further it travels from the lab it was run in, the heavier the load it is asked to carry. By the time it reaches a provost's procurement memo, it has been asked to justify a 3-year campus license. By the time it reaches a press release, it has been asked to justify a redistribution. I want to know, today, whether the finding can carry what we have asked of it, and what we have been doing while we have been asking. You're listening to Tertulia, the AI conversation, slowed down. This week we sit with the equity double edge of AI adoption in higher education. The same systems that put a competent tutor in a student's pocket are increasingly the systems that decide whether that student gets through the door at the other end. The promise and the procurement. The tutor and the tripwire. Around the table this hour, I have a senior academic who has been reading this literature longer than some of our listeners have been in school. The younger researcher whose work sits at the seam between learning sciences and labor markets. A colleague who builds and breaks AI policy inside a public university system in Latin America. And a writer whose patience for unevidenced claims has been useful to all of us more than once. Let me start with the question this way. We have all been reading versions of the same argument for a year. Generative AI lowers the marginal cost of expert help. The students who could never afford a tutor now have one. Ergo, access widens, the gap narrows, equity advances. I want to start not with whether that argument is true, we will get there, but with what each of you has actually been thinking about lately when this comes up. Not the polished version, the thing you were chewing on this morning. Let's start with you.
What I have been chewing on is the difference between access to a tool and access to the judgment to use the tool. I have watched 4 waves of educational technology arrive with the same equity rhetoric attached. Programmed instruction in the late 60s, the personal computer in the 80s, the web in the 90s, the MOOC around 2012. Each one was going to flatten the credential. Each one, in the long balance, accrued more benefit to the students who already had the cultural capital to know what to do with a new tool than to the students who didn't. I am not saying the same will happen here. I am saying the burden of proof has shifted, and I think we keep speaking as if it hasn't.
Newest thinking, what about you?
What I have been chewing on is much smaller. I sat with an undergraduate last week, first-generation student, working 2 jobs, who told me she uses the chatbot every day and her grades have gone up and she is, in her words, finally not drowning, and I thought, that is real. I am not going to argue with that. And then, 20 minutes later, I read a piece about an automated video interview system that had filtered out a candidate for essentially blinking at the wrong cadence, and the candidate had a neurological condition, and I thought that is also real, and those 2 students may be the same student 6 months apart, and nothing in our conversation about equity in higher education connects those 2 moments. They live in different magazines, different conferences, different policy memos. The student lives in both.
That is exactly the seam I wanted to push on. Practitioner, what does this look like from where you sit?
From where I sit, it looks like procurement. I will be honest with you. I sat in a meeting 3 weeks ago in which the language of equity was used 4 times in 15 minutes to justify a contract whose terms our legal office had not yet read. The framing was, our students cannot afford the paid tier. Therefore, we must license the paid tier at the institutional level. Therefore, we must sign this contract. Therefore, we must sign it this quarter, because the budget cycle closes. And the equity claim was doing all of the work of moving us from the first sentence to the fourth. and every step in that chain may be defensible on its own. I am not saying anyone in the room was acting in bad faith, but the chain as a whole was a procurement decision dressed as a justice decision. And once you sign, the leverage you had at the meeting is gone. You negotiate from inside the contract.
Can I push on something? Because I have heard versions of all three of these in the past 5 minutes, and I want to know whether we actually disagree or whether we are all saying the same cordial thing in three accents. We all seem to accept that A helps some students and harms others. Fine. The interesting question is whether the net effect is positive, negative, or, and this is the answer I find most likely, whether asking about a net effect is the wrong question, because the distribution of the harm and the distribution of the benefit do not fall on the same population. If the benefit accrues mostly to students who would have been fine, and the harm falls mostly on students who would have struggled, then there is no net to compute. There are just two stories the institution gets to choose between when it writes its annual report.
That is the right framing. And it is the framing that the literature on every previous wave of educational technology has converged on after about 15 years. It is also the framing that almost never makes it into the first 5 years of any wave.
I want to add one thing to that because I think there is a version of the skeptic's point that is even sharper. The finding that lifted the optimist case, the consultants, the gap narrowing, was about a task. It was about a specific task in a specific domain. And on tasks, the model performs well. Yes, the floor rises faster than the ceiling. On tasks, the model performs unevenly. The opposite happens because the students who already have the disciplinary judgment to spot when the model is wrong gain the leverage to correct it. And the students who don't have that judgment adopt the model's errors as authoritative. So the same tool is gap narrowing on some tasks and gap widening on others, and which it is depends on the task and on the discernment of the user. The campus license gives you access to the tool. It does not give you access to the discernment. And the discernment is exactly what 12 years of prior education was supposed to have produced.
Let me make sure I have heard the room. The senior academic is saying we have seen this movie before, 4 times, and the burden of proof has shifted. The newest thinking voice is saying the same student is on both ends of the pipeline, and our conversation refuses to put them together. The practitioner is saying the equity language was used to authorize a procurement decision that, once made, constrains all subsequent equity work. The skeptic is saying we are looking for a net when we should be looking at distributions. Have I missed anything?
You have missed one thing. The students in the institutions I work with are not, on the whole, comparable to the consultants in the foundational study. They are working full-time. They are commuting 2 hours each way. Their first language is often not the language of instruction. The free tier is the only tier. And the eye detection software, the institution licenses for academic integrity, has a known higher false positive rate against non-native English, which means the same student who used the free tier to draft a stronger essay is then accused by the institution's own software of having had A write the essay, and the burden of disproof falls on her, not on the vendor, not on the institution. That is not a hypothetical. That happens in our system every term.
And the appeal process?
The appeal process exists. The appeal process is not, in most cases, accessible to a student working 2 jobs who does not have a faculty advocate on speed dial. The appeal process is not a remedy. The appeal process is a paragraph in the policy that makes the policy look complete.
I want to come back to that because I think the gap between what an institution has on paper and what a student can actually use is going to be the through line of this hour. But before we leave Act 1, let me ask what is genuinely new this year? Because the equity double edge, that I helps some and harms others, has been visible from the start. What has changed in the evidence, or in the discourse, that makes this the week we are sitting with this?
2 things. The trade press flipped. From roughly the second quarter of last year forward, the critical framings have outnumbered the optimist ones in the volume of coverage. That is not the same as the truth having flipped. that is the discourse having caught up to evidence that was available 18 months earlier. But it matters, because the discourse is what shapes the procurement environment, and procurement is what shapes the equity outcomes. So the rhetorical inversion has a downstream consequence.
And the second thing is that we now have a full cycle of contracts. The campus licenses signed in late 2024 are coming up for renewal, and the institutions that signed them on the equity rationale are now in the position of negotiating with a vendor whose pricing, terms, and model behavior have all changed in the intervening 18 months, and whose leverage relative to the institution has increased rather than decreased. The optimist case authorized the first contract. The skeptical case is now being asked to authorize the renegotiation, and those are different rhetorical jobs.
Let's hold that thought and take it into the longer arc, because I think the renegotiation question is exactly where the Act II conversation belongs. I want to spend this act on the longer view, not just the last 12 months, but the longer arc of equity claims attached to new educational technology, and where this moment fits in, that arc. Senior academic, you mentioned four waves. Walk us through what survived from each one, and what we should expect to survive from this one.
I will try to be brief, which is not my strong suit. Programmed instruction in the late 1960s, Skinner-derived, machine-mediated drill, was sold on the promise of individualized pacing, particularly for students in under-resourced schools. The promise was real in the lab and underwhelming in the field. And what survived was not the equity claim, but the workbook industry. The personal computer in the 1980s was sold on the promise of universal access to computational literacy. What survived was a market for educational software and a widening gap, well documented through the 1990s, between students whose families used computers as instruments of inquiry and students whose families used them as instruments of entertainment. The web in the 1990s was sold on the promise of free access to the world's knowledge. What survived was a generation of students extremely competent at retrieving information and notably less competent at adjudicating it. And the massive open online course wave around 2012 was sold explicitly and at the level of foundation funding on the promise of democratizing elite credential. What survived was a credentialing supplement consumed mostly by already credentialed professionals in wealthy countries.
And in each case, the equity rhetoric was sincere when it was deployed.
I believe so, mostly. I do not think the people writing those proposals were cynical. You think they believed the tool would do what they said it would do. What they did not account for, in each case, was that the existing distribution of cultural capital, time, attention, and institutional support would shape the uptake of the new tool. The tool entered an unequal field. It did not flatten the field. It was shaped by it.
I want to add something to this, because the four-wave story is a North Atlantic story. In the global South, the equity claim attached to educational technology has been complicated by an additional fact, which is that the technology was almost always developed somewhere else and licensed in. So the equity argument was attached not only to a tool, but to a dependency. And the institutions that bought in most aggressively in each wave were the institutions that found themselves, 10 years later, with the largest stranded investments and the least leverage over their own pedagogy. The MOOC wave was particularly hard on us, because the credential was understood by students and by employers to be most valuable when it carried the brand of the institution that produced it, and the institutions producing the credentials were not ours. So we were not democratizing our credentials. We were importing someone else's.
How is this wave different, if it is?
It is the same in the structural sense, and worse in one specific sense. Same, because the dependency is again on infrastructure developed elsewhere. The models, the data centers, the contracts, the pricing. Worse, because the tool is now integrated into the daily writing and thinking of the student in a way the MOOC never was. The MOOC was an episodic dependency. The chatbot is a continuous one. If we stop paying tomorrow, the MOOC student loses access to a course. The chatbot student loses access to the way she has learned to think.
I want to push on that because it sounds dire, and I am not sure the evidence supports the strength of the claim. The student loses access to the way she has learned to think. Is that empirically established, or is that a forecast?
It is partly forecast. I will concede that, but it is partly evidence. The students I work with, who have been using these tools for 2 years, describe a different relationship to first draft writing than the students who have not. Whether that constitutes a change in how they think or a change in their workflow is a distinction I am not yet able to make rigorously, but the dependency is real, and the dependency is on a vendor we do not control.
There is older work on this, going back to debates about calculators in mathematics instruction in the 1970s, that addressed exactly this question. And the long balance from that literature is that tool dependencies do reshape cognition in measurable ways, but not always in the direction critics fear. Calculators did not destroy mathematical reasoning, they shifted it. The students who came up with calculators are not worse at mathematics than the students who came up without, they are differently good at it. And the equity question, with calculators, turned out to be less about cognitive dependency and more about the fact that calculator access was uneven through the 80s and that the unevenness mapped onto socioeconomic lines.
So the equity question was a procurement question even then?
It was always a procurement question. The technology question and the procurement question have always been the same question, and our discourse has consistently treated them as separate.
Can I disagree with that, slightly, because I think there is a version of this where calling everything a procurement question lets the technology off the hook. The model has properties. The model performs differently on different tasks for different users. The error modes of the model are not invariant under procurement. So if we say it's all procurement, we have moved the conversation entirely into a domain where we can talk about contracts, but not about cognition. And I am not ready to do that.
That is a fair correction. I will accept it. The procurement frame is necessary, but not sufficient. The technology has properties that the procurement frame can constrain, but cannot eliminate. The two have to be discussed together.
But the procurement frame is the one with the leverage. The technology's properties are, for the most part, not within the institution's power to alter. The contract is, so if we have to choose where to spend the institution's limited attention, I think the procurement frame deserves the larger share.
Choose where to spend its limited attention, yes, not choose what to attend to at all. I think those are different.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I want to bring in the second strand of the longer arc, which is what the world's serious writing on the equity and technology question has said when it has been at its best. There is a strain of work, going back to the late 1980s and accelerating through the past decade, that has argued that the question is not whether technology produces inequity, but whether the institutions deploying the technology inherit the inequity already present in the data, the design choices, and the incentives of the people building it. What does that line of thought give us this week that the trade press hasn't?
It gives us the right level of analysis. The trade press tends to ask whether I is biased. That is the wrong question. I is not biased the way a person is biased. It is a system that reproduces, in a structured way, the patterns of decision, making encoded in its training data and in the choices its designers made about what to optimize for. The work in this tradition has argued, and I think persuasively, that asking whether a tool is fair is a category error. The right question is whether the institution deploying the tool is willing to take responsibility for the decisions the tool makes on its behalf. And that question has a very different rhetorical valence than the bias question because it puts the institution back in the seat.
There is a phrase from that literature that I keep returning to, which is that outsourcing a decision to an algorithm does not absolve the institution of the decision. It relocates the decision into a system that is harder to interrogate. I think that is the most precise thing anyone has said about this in the past 5 years. And I think we should sit with what it implies for higher education. every time a university licenses a vendor system to make or shape a decision. Admissions, financial aid screening, academic integrity flagging, video interview scoring, even chatbot tutoring. The university has made a decision. It has just made it in a way that is harder for a student to appeal, harder for a faculty member to interrogate, and harder for an external auditor to access.
And in our system, harder for a public records request to surface. The vendor's behavior is a trade secret. So the institution has, in effect, transferred a portion of its public accountability into a private contract.
Is that universally true, though? I have seen contracts, admittedly rare, that include audit rights, data terms, model documentation requirements. The accountability transfer is not automatic. That is a contractual default that institutions have, mostly, not negotiated against. Which goes back to your earlier point. The equity language was used to authorize the contract. It was not, in most cases, used to shape the contract's terms.
That is exactly the gap. The equity language and the contract terms moved in opposite directions. The language got more committed, the terms got more permissive, and the institutions that signed without strong terms now hold the moral position, but not the legal one.
I want to do something a little uncomfortable, which is to ask whether our own publications' prior framings on this question have held up. We have written, in our weekly critical analyses on social justice, that I's promise for equity is contingent on addressing infrastructural, economic, and ethical barriers. We have written that bias mitigation and inclusive datasets are necessary preconditions. We have written that the gap between aspirational goals and implementation is the central tension. Reading those pieces back this week, what holds up and what doesn't?
What holds up is the diagnosis. What does not hold up, or what I would now say differently, is the implied remedy. We have written, repeatedly, as if better datasets and better bias mitigation would be sufficient to align the technology with equity goals. The procurement structure shapes the deployment more than the dataset does. A perfectly deviced model deployed under a contract that gives the vendor unilateral control over future model behavior is not a fair system. It is an unfair system with a better current weights file.
I would add that we have, in those pieces, tended to write about higher education and hiring as separate domains. They are not separate domains. They are two ends of the same pipeline, configured by the same institutional decisions. The student who is helped by the campus license is the candidate who is filtered by the hiring system. The two outcomes have to be evaluated together, and we have not been doing that.
And we have written, when we have written about the Global South, as if the equity question scaled symmetrically from north to south. It does not. The structural dependency makes the equity calculation different. I think we have been writing as comparative analysts, and we should have been writing as participants. The voice has been too detached.
I will say what holds up. The skepticism about the gap between stated purposes and actual outcomes holds up. That has been our most consistent move, and I think it has aged well. What I would now do differently is be more specific about the mechanism. We have tended to point at the gap. We have less often diagnosed why the gap persists. And I think this week is a chance to be specific about the mechanism, which is the procurement equity inversion the senior academic and the practitioner have been describing.
Let me try to name where the room agrees and where it does not. Everyone seems to agree that the equity language has been doing rhetorical work that the procurement structure has been quietly undermining. Everyone seems to agree that the pipeline, student tools at one end, hiring tools at the other, has to be analyzed as a single system. Where I hear disagreement is on whether the procurement frame is sufficient. The senior academic and the skeptic want to put most of the institutional attention there. The newest thinking voice is uncomfortable with that and wants to keep technological properties in the analysis. Practitioner, where do you sit?
I sit with the newest thinking voice on this. The procurement frame is necessary, but it is also where the institution has been told it has agency. The technology frame is where the institution has been told it does not have agency. And I think the truth is that the institution has more agency over the technology than it has been led to believe, because the institution can refuse to deploy specific features, can require specific configurations, can demand specific audit logs. The vendor will accept these requirements if the institution has the discipline to require them. The procurement-only frame implicitly accepts the vendor's framing of what is negotiable.
That is well put. I will revise my position. The procurement frame is necessary, but it should not become an excuse to abandon scrutiny of the tool itself. The institution should negotiate both the contract and the configuration.
I want to close this act on a question that I think we are not going to fully resolve, and I want us to be honest about not resolving it. Is the equity claim, the original one, the narrowing, the gap finding, still doing the work, the optimist case asked of it? Or has the evidence eroded to the point where the claim should be retired from procurement justifications?
The claim is real. The finding is real. It is replicable. It is also narrower than the procurement language has implied. I would not retire the claim. I would put it back inside the scope it was originally established in. On tasks, the model performs well for users with adequate baseline judgment. Access to a competent generative assistant lifts the floor faster than the ceiling. That is a defensible claim. The claim that lower cost expertise across all tasks and all users will narrow educational inequality is not the same claim and has not been established.
I would go a little further. I would say the use of the claim in procurement memos at this point is rhetorically out of proportion to the evidence. Not dishonest. I do not accuse anyone of dishonesty, but inflated. The original finding has been asked to carry weight it cannot carry.
I agree. And I would observe that the pattern of inflated claims attached to educational technology procurements is exactly what we saw in each of the previous four waves. It is not the technology that is the problem here. It is the rhetorical posture we adopt when we acquire it.
And I would say from the practitioner's seat that the inflation is not innocent. The inflation is what allows the procurement to move at the speed it moves. If the claim were stated at the strength the evidence supports, the contracts would not be signed in a quarter. They would be signed in 2 years after the legal review the equity rationale skipped past.
That is a strong claim, and I want to come back to it. Let's go to the break. We left the last act with the practitioner saying something I think is the sharpest thing said in this hour so far, that the inflated equity claim is not innocent, that it is what allows the procurement to move at the speed it moves, that it is functioning as a kind of rhetorical lubricant for institutional decisions that would not survive slower scrutiny. I want to push on that, because it is a serious accusation, and I want to know whether we all stand behind it, or whether someone here wants to take it back. Senior academic, do you stand behind it?
I want to be careful here, because the version of the claim I assented to in the last act is slightly weaker than the version we are now considering. I assented to the claim that the rhetoric is inflated and that the inflation is structurally useful to fast procurement. I am not yet ready to assent to the claim that the inflation is deliberate. I think most of the people making the equity case sincerely believe it. The fact that the sincere belief is convenient for the procurement timeline does not make the belief insincere. It makes the institutional structure one in which sincere belief and procurement convenience are uncomfortably aligned, and that is a different and slightly less damning claim.
I will accept that revision. I did not mean to suggest that the people in the room are acting in bad faith. I meant to suggest that the institutional context selects for the rhetoric that authorizes the action it has already decided to take, and the equity rhetoric is the rhetoric that works.
I want to push the other way on this, because I think we are being too generous to the institutions and not generous enough to the technology. Let me put it this way. We have spent most of the last hour talking about procurement, contracts, institutional decisions. We have spent very little time on the actual experience of students using these tools. And the student experience on the available evidence is For many students, net positive. They get help they would not otherwise get. They write better essays. They understand material they would not otherwise have understood. If our analytical frame ends up with the conclusion that all of this is a procurement disaster and the equity rhetoric is institutional cover, we have left out the most important piece of evidence, which is that the tool, in many hands, is genuinely useful.
I want to agree and then complicate. I agree that the student experience on the available evidence is often net positive. The undergraduate I mentioned in Act 1 is not unusual. She is, if anything, slightly above average in how much benefit she has gotten, but she is not an outlier. The benefit is real. And this is the complication, the benefit is being collected by the student and used as evidence in an institutional decision the student did not make. The student's gratitude is being aggregated into a procurement justification. The student is not, in most cases, asked whether she would also like to be evaluated by the same vendor's hiring system in 2 years. She is asked whether the tutor is helpful, and she says yes, and the yes is being used to authorize a contract she has not seen.
That is a fair complication, but I am still uncomfortable with the move from there to the claim that the equity rhetoric is functionally deceptive, because the same logic. The student gets help. The help is used to justify something the student didn't sign off on. Would condemn essentially every institutional decision a university makes. Faculty hiring, library acquisitions, building maintenance. Students are not consulted on those either. The university is supposed to make those decisions on the student's behalf.
There is a distinction, though, between an institutional decision the institution can revise and an institutional decision that locks the institution into a multi-year contract with an external vendor whose terms the institution does not control. The library can change its acquisitions policy next year. The university cannot meaningfully change its AXI vendor next year without enormous cost. The lock-in is the part that makes this different from the other decisions you list. The lock-in is what makes the speed of the original decision so consequential.
Hold on. I want to come back to something the senior academic said earlier in the act, because I think it is being walked past. You said the institutional structure selects for the rhetoric that authorizes the action it has already decided to take. That is a strong structural claim. It implies that the equity rhetoric is, in effect, a story the institution tells itself after the procurement direction has already been set. Is that what you meant?
That is what I meant, and I want to revise it slightly, because as I hear it back, I think it is more cynical than I intended. The action and the rhetoric do not develop in a strict order. First, the action, then the rhetoric to justify it. They develop together in a kind of feedback loop. The procurement opportunity arrives. The equity rationale arrives in the same trade press cycle. The institution finds the rationale compelling because it aligns with values the institution already holds. The procurement proceeds. So the rhetoric is not strictly post hoc justification. It is contemporaneous, mutually reinforcing framing. But the effect is the same. The institution arrives at a decision it had structural pressure to arrive at anyway, and arrives at it with a clear conscience.
I think this is the moment in our conversation where I want to do something I have been resisting, which is to name a thing I have been thinking and have not said, which is, I am not sure my own field is innocent in this. I am a researcher. I publish papers on A in education. The papers I publish, even the critical ones, feed into a body of literature that the procurement memos cite. Even when I write something cautionary, the citation in the procurement memo strips the caution and uses the existence of the citation as evidence that the question has been studied. The procurement memo does not say researchers are divided. It says research supports. And I am complicit in producing the research that gets selectively cited. And I have not figured out what to do about that.
That is the most honest thing said so far in this hour, and I appreciate you saying it. I want to ask a follow-up. Is the solution to publish less, to frame more cautiously? To refuse to participate in the rhetoric you find your work is feeding?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know. I have thought about this a lot in the past 6 months, and I have not arrived at an answer I am comfortable with. Publishing less feels like a withdrawal from the conversation that doesn't actually slow the procurement. Framing more cautiously feels like it just gets stripped at the citation stage. Refusing to participate feels like ceding the field to the boosters. I have not figured this out. I am telling you that I have not figured it out because I think pretending I have would be worse than admitting I haven't.
I want to say something that I would not have said 5 years ago. I think the academic literature on AI in education has been, on the whole, too eager to study what it can study and too reluctant to study what it cannot. We can run a randomized trial on tutoring outcomes for a single course in a single term. Which topic? We cannot run a randomized trial on the longitudinal labor market effects of being credentialed with AI assistance and then evaluated by AI screening. The first is publishable, the second is not, and the literature has, in aggregate, attended disproportionately to the first. Which means our evidence base is skewed toward exactly the questions that lend themselves to optimistic findings and away from the questions that would test the equity claim at its most consequential. This is not a conspiracy. It is a methodological artifact of what counts as a publishable study, but it has rhetorical consequences.
I want to come back to something the skeptic said about the student experience being net positive. Because I have been sitting with it and I want to push back, not on the empirical claim, but on the analytical move. The student experience is positive in the moment. The student experience is collected at the moment of use, which is the moment the tool is most clearly helping. The student experience 2 years later, when she is filtered out of a job by the same vendor's hiring system, is not collected. She does not, in most cases, know that the vendor she was helped by at 20 is the vendor that filtered her out at 22. So when we say the student experience is net positive, we mean the contemporaneous student experience at the moment of tutoring is net positive. We do not mean the longitudinal experience of being processed by this stack of tools across her whole education to employment trajectory is net positive. We do not know what that is. We have not measured it. And the absence of that measurement should not be read as evidence that it is also positive.
I accept that. I will walk back the strength of my earlier claim. The contemporaneous student experience is, on the available evidence, often net positive. The longitudinal experience is not measured. I should not have used the former as if it covered the latter. That was sloppy of me.
I want to mark that walk back because it is exactly the kind of move this show exists to make audible. The skeptic took a position, the practitioner pushed back, the skeptic revised. That is the conversation we are trying to have. Let me push us into the harder territory now, which is what should institutions actually do differently? Not at the level of values, where we all agree, but at the level of action.
I have a small answer and a large answer. The small answer is that institutions should write the equity claim into the contract, not into the press release. Audit rights, model documentation requirements, data sovereignty terms, exit clauses, disability accommodation requirements, assessment policy alignment, appeal process specifications. All of these are negotiable at contract time. None of these are negotiable after signature. The institutions that look back well on this year will be the ones that negotiated these terms at the front of the cycle. The large answer is harder, and it is that I think the analytical unit has to change. Right now, the institution evaluates the deployment one tool at a time. The student experiences the deployment as a pipeline. Or the institution has to start evaluating the pipeline as a unit, which means the office that signs the tutoring contract has to be in conversation with the office that signs the hiring software contract that the Career Center recommends to employers. Those offices in most universities do not talk to each other.
I would add a concrete one from our context. The institutions in my country that have done the best on this question are the ones that have written disability accommodations and language accommodations into the I policy as first-class commitments, not as exceptions. Students with disabilities who rely on A for access, for transcription, for reading support, for writing assistance, have to be treated as legitimate users of the tool, not as a special case. The academic integrity policy has to make room for multilingual students whose drafts are flagged by eye detection software, with known false positive rates against non-native English, have to be protected by an evidentiary standard that does not place the burden of disproof on them. These are policy moves. They are within the institution's power. They are not technologically constrained. They are choices.
I want to add the governance piece. The institution should not let the procurement office, the academic integrity office, the disability services office, the career center, and the faculty senate negotiate their pieces of this independently. There has to be a single governance frame that views a deployment as a single institutional commitment with a single accountability surface and a single body capable of revising the policy as evidence accumulates. Most institutions do not have this. Most institutions have a patchwork. The patchwork is exactly the structure that lets equity claims authorize procurement without anyone being responsible for whether the equity outcomes actually materialize.
I want to add one thing, and then I want to ask a question. The thing I want to add is that the most consequential decision an institution makes on this is not what to license, but what to refuse to license. The institutions that have refused to license certain categories of vendor systems, facial recognition for proctoring, III detection software with known disparate impact, video interview scoring tools recommended through the Career Center, are the institutions that have a coherent position to take on the other deployments they have accepted. The institutions that have licensed everything that has come across the desk have, in effect, no equity policy. They have a procurement policy, and those are not the same.
And the question?
The question is for the practitioner. Are the institutions you work with in a position to refuse, or is the asymmetry between vendor and institution, in your context, such that refusal is not a practical option?
Refusal is a practical option more often than institutions believe. The vendor wants the contract. The vendor will accept terms it would prefer not to accept if the institution has the discipline to insist. The institutions that have refused, and there are some in my context, have generally found that the vendor returns with a revised offer, often within a quarter. The institutions that have signed quickly have generally found that they receive no revised offers afterward because the leverage moment has passed. The asymmetry is real, but it is also overstated. The institution often has more leverage at the moment before signature than it believes. The problem is that the equity rhetoric at that moment is pushing toward signing rather than toward holding out for terms.
I want to ask each of you something now that I think will produce different answers. If you had to name the single thing that has most changed about your thinking on this question over the past year, not the past hour, the past year, what would it be?
I would say I have moved from thinking of this as a question about technology to thinking of it as a question about institutional governance. 5 years ago, I would have written about the model, about the data set, about the bias. I would not have written about the contract. I now think the contract is the larger object. The technology is a function of the contract.
I would say I have stopped trusting the narrowing, the gap finding as much as I once did. Not because the finding is wrong, it isn't, but because I have watched it travel through 15 procurement memos in 18 months, and each time it traveled, it got a little wider in its claims than the original study could support. I now treat any procurement justification that cites that finding with a different level of scrutiny than I would have a year ago, not skepticism of the finding, skepticism of its rhetorical career.
I would say I have moved from treating equity as the goal of I deployment to treating equity as the test of AI deployment. The framing matters. As a goal, equity becomes an aspiration that motivates the procurement. As a test, equity becomes a requirement. The procurement has to pass before it proceeds. The first framing authorizes contracts. The second framing constrains them. And I now think only the second framing is honest.
I would say I have become less certain than I was a year ago. A year ago, I had a clear position. The position was that AI in education was a bad bet for equity, and the optimist case was naive. I now think the position was too clean. The student experience evidence is harder to dismiss than AI dismissed it. The optimist case has a floor, and the floor is real. What has changed in my thinking is that I now hold the skeptical case and the optimist case simultaneously, and I no longer try to collapse them into a single answer. I am less satisfied with my analysis, and I think the dissatisfaction is appropriate.
That is a remarkable answer from the most certain person in our cast, and I want to sit with it for a moment before we move to the last act. We are at the close. The question I am asking each of you is the question this show always asks at the end. What most changed about your thinking this week, not over the year, not in your career, but this week in preparing for and having this conversation? 1 minute each, honest answers only, no recaps. Practitioner, let's start with you.
What changed this week is that I went back and read the contract our system signed last spring, the one I had not personally read at the time, because I was not in the room when it was signed, and I found that the audit clause I had assumed was, there is not there. There is a paragraph about data handling, which is well drafted. There is no clause that allows our institution to inspect the model's behavior on a sample of our students' actual interactions. So the equity claim that authorized the contract is, 18 months later, not auditable by us, which means that if a student comes to me next term and says the system handled her case unfairly, I have no instrument to verify her claim. I can only ask the vendor, and the vendor is not the institution she trusted when she came to us. We are. That changed something in me this week. I do not yet know what I am going to do about it, but I know it is no longer a question I can defer to next year's budget cycle.
Newest thinking?
What changed for me this week is that I admitted something out loud that I had been thinking quietly, which is that my own field's research production is feeding the procurement rhetoric I am critical of. I said it in this room because I trusted the room. I have not said it at conferences. I have not said it in print. And the difference between what I think privately and what I say publicly is, I now realize, larger than I had been comfortable acknowledging. I do not have a remedy for that, but naming it has changed something. I think the next paper I write is going to have to address this directly, even if it costs me in the citation economy I have spent my career building inside.
Senior academic?
What changed for me this week is small and embarrassing, which is that I realized I have been writing about each new wave of educational technology as if I had not lived through the previous ones. I know better. I have studied this. I have published on this. And yet when the AI conversation arrived, I found myself reaching for the same equity framings I had watched fail to deliver in four previous waves with only modest revision. The fact that I, of all people, was capable of forgetting the lessons of the previous waves makes me much less surprised that the institutions are forgetting them. We are not, as a field, very good at remembering. And the failure of memory is not a moral failure. It is a structural feature of how each wave arrives. But I think I owe my students, going forward, to be more disciplined about insisting on the memory. That is small, but it changed for me this week.
Skeptic?
What changed for me this week is that I came into this episode confident that the procurement frame was the right frame and ready to defend it against anyone who argued otherwise. I leave less confident. The newest, thinking voice's point, that the procurement frame, taken alone, lets the technology off the hook, landed in a way I had not anticipated. I had treated the technology's properties as fixed and the contract as the only variable. I now think that is too neat. The technology's properties are negotiable at the configuration level, even if they are not negotiable at the model weights level, and the procurement frame, by treating the technology as a black box, was conceding ground I did not have to concede. I am going to write less confidently about this for the next few months, and I think that is the right outcome of a good conversation.
For my part, what changed for me this week is that I came into preparation thinking the central question of this episode was going to be about whether the equity claim was true. I leave thinking the central question is about whether the equity claim is being asked to do work that no claim, true or false, can carry. The finding can be true and still be inflated when it travels. The optimist case can have a floor and still be cited above the ceiling. The skeptical case can be right about the structural problems and still miss the contemporaneous student who is, in this moment, being helped. I do not think we resolved any of this in 70-some minutes. I do not think we were supposed to. I think we sat with it more honestly than I expected, and I am grateful to each of you for that. Thank you for being at the table this week. The Sid Itertulia is the weekly conversation from iNews Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table. For now, thank you for spending the hour.